Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday night discussion group. We're proud to be here in 2014. It's been a good new year. A lot of exciting things is happening at TMS Wiki. Anyway, I just want to bring up, we'll be discussing Steve Ozenich's book, The Great Pain Deception. We'll be talking about, in chapter 24, we'll be talking about drugs. And in chapter 25, we'll be talking about suffering. I need to let everybody know before we start that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. And if you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician or a TMS physician. Okay? Now, with that being said, I just want to, again, thank everybody for being here tonight. We got a lot of callers on the phone. So, again, this is about one of the subjects is drugs and the other is suffering. So that should have plenty for us to talk about. Okay, Bruce, you ready?
Well, chapter 24 has the title drugs, but it probably should be really labeled meds because yeah. These are in the context of TMS, there are various anodynes that you can take to avoid feeling pain. And since this chapter is so wide-ranging and it deals with so many subjects like the origins of heart attacks and supplements and how drugs actually work, I thought I would extract Steve's underlying argument. Being a good 80s person raised in a deconstructionist environment where you're supposed to deconstruct arguments from raw data, from all of the different perspectives coming in, I think you find that his argument runs something like this. He's saying that the absence of purpose, a spiritual yearning, underlies the addiction to numbing agents and usually presents itself in the form of pain or anxiety-related disorders. And what Steve is saying is do not use drugs to try to rid TMS pain. It makes the pain stay. The drugs force TMS into another type of symptom. They don't stop the problems. Drugs may be necessary, Steve thinks, in the short term, but they are never a long-term solution. Drugs don't take care of the problem, they shift it. The problem remains, and the sufferer then needs more drugs or with back surgeries, also that can perform the same kind of function, which gets close to the placebo response, to keep from attending to strong emotions. The net gain, once again, is nothing. Steve emphasizes that America has become a nation of hypochondriacs. If you have constant heartburn, you're under stress. You aren't suffering from acid reflux disease. Look for the reason behind the symptoms and remove the reason. Don't cover it up with various anodynes. And he talks about how, Steve talks about how sickness has been sold to the American public by the various big pharmaceutical companies. This one guy, the former Merck CEO, Henry Gadsden, in his interview with Fortune magazine, he restated his frustration that his firm was only selling drugs to sick people. Instead, he wanted to create a huge marketing opportunity by selling them to people who were already well. Creating the need, I think they call that. And then filling it.
Is this what the guy from Merck said?
Oh, yeah. It's on page 260.
Uh-huh.
He wants to sell to everyone. This is a big marketing effort. So you notice that where I go, to Kaiser, where if you cross a certain age threshold, they have a checklist of meds that they want to prescribe for you. I don't know what all of them are, probably thyroid, probably cholesterol, lowering cholesterol, ones for hypertension, until they have a check sheet. It's just like a cookie cutter approach to medicine, where age and statistics dictate a certain regimen of meds. And I think that's his basic argument. He prefaces this with a quote from this chapter, from a quote from Sir William Osler, MD, 1849-1919. He says, "The desire to take medicine is perhaps the greatest feature which distinguishes man from animals." And I don't think that, that chimpanzees and baboons are also self-medicating. But it certainly...
Animals, they just do it naturally. They smell what smells good and take it. But anyway, sorry.
Oh,
yeah, like deer seeking out aspirin in willow trees.
Everybody self-medicates. Yeah.
Wow.
Animals. But anyway,
good.
Sorry.
But what kind of question do you have to ask about this, Kirby?
If Enjoy could just say what she said again, we could start with that. She brought up something good. Enjoy, about the self-medicating.
Oh, I was just saying that all sentient beings self-medicate, really, because what they do is they smell something and it triggers a need in them. That's the whole basis of herbal medicine, is that you can actually, if you haven't destroyed your senses, you can actually smell what you need, and then you can eat that plant or whatever. And animals all do that automatically. But people are the only creatures that will pour poison down their throat and think it's going to do them some good. I'm not a big fan of the pharmaceutical industry, actually. But, I mean, they have their place, you know, but we got, they're way out of control.
Yeah, I mean, thank God for the, you know, the medicines that help us live and help us get through. And there's medicines out there that if a lot of people didn't have them, their life wouldn't be that great, and a lot of people would die. But you know, Enjoy, as much as all of us, we're talking about the drugs that we don't need, the things that we've been told we do need, and we don't need them, and we can actually get by and get better if we can just get, you know, our stress levels under control and get the tension under control and just get back to living life better. But something that Bruce brought up just a minute ago about that company that said their main thing was to sell drugs to healthy people. Is that what it was said in the book?
It's like Merck CEO Henry Gadsden's interview with Fortune magazine. He restated his frustration that his firm was only selling drugs to sick people, and that his dream, quote unquote, was to be able to sell drugs to healthy people. They could then sell to everyone, medicate the world. So everyone has to have meds.
So I can see why, you know, Enjoy says what she says. I can see why we understand why there's a chapter here on it. And I myself have had times. This is a part that I read from Steve's book. It kind of goes like this. Often the longer a person takes a medication for a symptom, the longer the symptom remains. The drug can bind a person to their pain, acting as a trigger for it. If the person stops taking the drug, the symptom may go away. And I remember years and years ago, it's been a while, I'm not going to tell everybody how long. Anyway, I'm getting pretty old, in other words. But anyway, I remember I was the doctor's, I think when I got about 20 years old, the doctor's gave me some pain medicine for all the pain I was having at the time. And it did start to help. And but then after like a month, it seemed like it was getting worse. It seemed like the pain was getting worse. So I had to, you know, take a little more, you know. And then there came Vaux. There came this medicine called Vaux. And so I told, and the doctor said, you can take one of these a day, Herbert, and it will help you. And I took it, and I took that one Vaux, and I think it was placebo. I had more relief from pain from the one Vaux than I did from any of the pain medications, and I let up on the pain medication. I didn't hurt near as bad. In other words, when I came off the pain medication, I didn't hurt near as bad from not taking the pain medicine as I did from just taking the one Vaux, which was not a pain medication. So in other words, while I was taking a pain medication, I hurt more, is what I'm saying. What I went through. That was something I went through. And my question would be, is somebody had any similar results, you know, when it comes to medications?
I think on page 262, Steve has a section called Deep Belief in Anything is the Master Key. And he says it may well be because one sufferer had his confidence built up regarding the drug and or just happened to be having a good day when he took it, or from any other possible unconscious forces. Once it works, a drug tends to work repeatedly, as conditioning takes hold immediately. So the real change he seems to be implying that occurs is going on inside of yourself, inside of your own autoimmune system, based on belief in the drug. See, I remember when my doctor prescribed Qvar for me, which is a steroid for asthma, and I took it, and I noticed just tremendous improvement. Just one puff a day. And here I was walking along and all of my symptoms went away, the ones that I'd been suffering with, strangely, since my mother died.
So is it like it?
And then, then I talked to another guy who had asthma and he was having troubles and they were giving him different drugs. And I said, hey, take this stuff, Qvar, and it's been working wonders for everyone at Kaiser in the allergy department, including some of the nurses there. And he took it, and nothing happened. Mm. It did not affect him. I wondered if I was caught up in a consensus mentality created by all of the good stories that were coming back to me from the nurses and the doctors, whether there was a community of faith at the Kaiser Allergy Department that was making Qvar work for me, because it was like, I believe it seemed to work and I was getting better and I believed and then it worked. So, you know, this is what Steve is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had faith and it continues to work for me. Maybe the faith that was established due to that miraculous turnaround right then, due to other factors like getting over my mother's death, inheriting some money, having some leisure time, getting a new life. Maybe that's what makes it work. Maybe I associate the chemical reaction created by the Qvar with improvements. So I do improve. It's really hard to tell with this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like
drug or whether it's yourself.
Yeah, it's like it was mentioned in the book there. You know, I mean, you take this medicine and you say you get, for some whatever reason, you get to feeling a little better that day. Automatically, you know, you got some compound interest the next time you take it. You just know you're going to feel better. And really, it's the power of your body's just taking to it and making you better.
Success predicts success.
Correct.
Which isn't to say that medicines in general can't work. I mean, obviously, a lot of medicines are going to, but one has to be careful.
Yeah, I remember watching on the Dr. Sarno video, and one of the guys, the one that's, you know, so hot going right now on TMS Wiki, one of the guys mentioned about would taking medicine prevent him from healing all the way? And Dr. Sarno said, you know, he wanted everybody to know that if you're hurting, you know, if you're really hurting, and that's the whole thing that started up the whole TMS knowledge therapy and all. Yeah, take it so you can, you know, feel better and not sit there and just be in all that pain. But eventually, as you start to heal and get better, as you start to get to the repressed emotions, as you start to, you know, start to look at life in a better view, start to be aware of your negative, you know, personality traits and stuff, and you start getting better, you keep taking the pain medicine, then it can dull. It can dull your healing. Is basically the way Sarno was putting it. But I remember in Mind, I believe it's Mind Over Back Pain. Is that the first one, the first book?
Yeah, his first one.
Yeah, and in that one, he said if he could, he said TMS pain is the worst pain there is. And he said, you know, at its extreme. And in the book, he said if he could prescribe heroin, if he could prescribe that, he would to some of these patients because the pain is so bad, was his point. The pain is so bad. But as you start to get better, now that was just his cliche talking, you know. But as you get better, then you need to, you know, back off this type of pain medicine so you can continue to get better, right? You see what I'm saying? I know everybody does. But anyway, we're talking about drugs in general, and the point is, they've got all these studies, like this one, I think it was in Walt's summary that he had on the TMS wiki, about how laughter boosts the immune system, how it releases endorphins, and it helps you feel better. And has anybody ever been hurting, and then you just get your mind off the pain for a little bit, and the next thing you know, when you think back about it, the pain wasn't there for that little bit of while.
I've noticed here? When I was hurting, if I had a companion with me when I would go out for a walk, if I engaged them in a conversation, I would forget about my pain because the talking to another person distracted me from my focus on it. Yeah. And I'd forget about it. But do you notice in this chapter, Herbie, where in this section where Steve talks about alter my mood, someone or something, please make me happy. Steve asks, why do mood-altering drugs such as antidepressants do physiologically within the brain? What do they do? Their overall effect comes from increasing the flow of neurotransmitters. So you can see how taking an antidepressant could, in effect, cancel out your TMS pain. It's like by becoming happy... anything that would change the neurochemistry of your brain would in effect stop the pain response. Thus, you could prescribe antidepressants to someone instead of an opioid.
Yeah.
And I think they've noticed that, haven't they?
I think absolutely, yeah.
Empathy for us where taking an antidepressant rather than a painkiller seems to get rid of TMS pain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is kind of like the perfect example of extreme TMS, chronic, goes on forever. And they're looking around for what drugs. Obviously, the people at Merck, like you were mentioning, they really, really want to sell drugs to that market, to the people with fibromyalgia. And a lot of the drugs that they're prescribing are just antidepressants. The idea being, well, they don't see it that way, but it seems pretty clear to us that, you know, the antidepressants defeat the pain for what you're saying.
I know a lady with extreme fibromyalgia that I run into hiking out at Edgewood County Park every once in a while. A couple times ago, I saw her and she was in a bad way with a walking stick and just limping along. And then I saw her a few months later, last week or so, and she was much happier. And she didn't have the stick anymore, and she was moving along much more smoothly. And Kaiser would just give her opioids, give her some kind of painkillers. But I just brought up the topic. Oh, you're not fighting with your daughter anymore, are you? And she said, no, we're getting along and working around the house. And that was the change. I said, I told you there was something back there that was driving this stuff. And it was gratifying to see the that relationship in her family was what was alleviating the symptoms.
That's awesome. Has anybody got anything they want to say about what we've been hitting on here so far? Because I'll bring this up a lot, but I remember at 29 when I went in to church, went into the ministry. I remember how at that time I write about it a lot on TMS Wiki, but I remember how I had about 8 or 9 years, close to 10 years, being at a level 1 or 2 at the most pain. And that had been the first time in 15 years that I had went down that low on the pain scale. And one of the things that I learned to do was give all my problems, my stresses, the things that I would worry about, usually I would give it to my higher power. And that took a lot of stress off me. And when I learned to do that, and I learned to, you know, being the joy ram, so to say, you know, and you put all that together, and I was standing up doing things like preaching and things that made me fear, the pain almost went totally away. And I remember how I started, though. I started giving my problems, my stresses, my worries, you know, over to my higher power. And now when I think about it, it was because I shifted my consciousness and I went to a higher state of consciousness. And I didn't, it was, if there was ever a worry anymore, I didn't worry about it. I had, you know, Jesus Christ was going to take care of that for me. So, hey man, you know, then you understand that I'm not worried about it. I'm not stressing over it. So all the, you know, the life of worry that I'd grown up to, I wasn't having it no more because I was giving it over to my higher power. So in effect, I was getting better. I was healing, and I did. To me, I was totally healed, but I still had that pain running down the back of my legs, you know. But it wasn't bad. It was just a little bit. But anyway, that's, you know, one of the ways that I didn't have to take any pain medicine there I think I only took it for like a year when I was real young. But anyway, anybody want to elaborate on drugs, any type of drug that you might have took before and then you found out that you really didn't need it after a while, and now you know why you didn't need it? There was something else that you might have needed in your life besides that drug.
Well, I had a situation how long ago now, about 10 years, 11 years ago now, where my doctor was starting to put me on drugs for side effects to the drugs she already had me on.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and I was just as a dog. I thought I was either dying or I wished I was. And I was really, really sick for 2 years. And then one of her brain waves was to double the dosage of one of the drugs she had me on. So as soon as I doubled that dosage, I knew what was making me sick, and it was this particular drug. So I kicked the whole lot of them. There were about 12 at this point.
Yeah.
And of course she was furious, and I got myself into all kinds of trouble, and I've got against medical advice written on my chart, and doctors won't talk to me anymore, but that's okay. I feel fine. This is 10 years at least later, and I'm good to go. And what was wrong with me is I had diabetes type 2, and it was not responding to diet and exercise, and I really was doing it, but the doctors, of course, have no way of knowing that, so they thought I was probably not doing it, mm-hmm. and kept giving me, you know, more and more of these meds, eh? So for the last 10 years or so, I just haven't worried about it. You know, just skip it, and I'm still just absolutely fine. And to tell you the honest truth,
awesome.
You know, the notion that those drugs that they had me on were going to somehow prolong my life is got to be baloney. It's got to be baloney because I was, I mean, those things are toxic for Pete's sake. It's fine if you need them and you have to have them. But if you don't need them and you feel fine without them, then I just think you have to let it go. And just a couple of months ago, I actually read about a study that a guy in Britain did, and it's in one of their big medical journals, a top-notch guy, and he has studied all the literature on the connection between having your blood sugars wonky and out of control and the kind of stuff that happens to diabetes, you know, like they get kidney disease, they go blind, their feet fall off, the whole bit, eh? And you know what? There's no damn correlation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no correlation. Mm. Some people get kidney disease. Some people get problems with their circulation. Some people don't. It has nothing to do with how steady they keep their blood sugar. So you see,
it's incidental. It's incidental.
What we're dealing with here is dealing with a medical profession that does not yet have the basis to reach the conclusions that they reach, because they were absolutely sure that I had to keep my blood sugar absolutely steady. Well, my blood sugar doesn't work that way. I can't keep it steady. It doesn't make any difference what I do. I can be exercising, I can be eating properly, I can be taking my meds, and it still goes up and down. Mm-hmm. That's just me. But I don't have any side effects, so what's the big deal? I still got both feet and both eyes, and I'm doing fine. So I mean, you I don't know. Like I'm not saying that I don't trust pharmaceutical companies because they're corporations, and corporations are psychopaths, and you know they're driven by the bottom line. But the individuals are probably, you know, most of them are trying to do their best by us. But they don't know enough yet. I think we have to be really, really careful what we accept. And if it's killing you, notice.
Well, I think,
yes,
you, I think
that's
you,
important. If it's
you
killing
have to be,
you, notice.
You have to be really careful either way. I mean, obviously, another thing that you don't want to do is not take a medicine that could save you. So it's something that I think, and this is something that I think needs to be repeated. It's an important thing that, you know, again, we're not doctors here, and these are the types of things that you need to talk to your MD about, and at least know that perspective. I also have, you know, there's a time when a doctor said, you know, your life would be easier if you took such and such drug. And I said, well, I don't want to take that drug. And she looked at me and she said, okay, you know, I wish you would, but you know, that's your choice. But I think it's important to have the conversation and recognize the value of getting that information as well. I guess that's something I feel I need to say, because, you know,
yeah.
I don't know who's listening, and we want to make sure that we don't harm anyone.
That's right.
But I think that
accepting the idea that, okay, kick the doctors, because that's ridiculous. I mean, they've been working for thousands of years to find good ways to help us. So absolutely, we've got to listen to them. Absolutely. No doubt about it. I would never, ever suggest to somebody that they not listen and hear their doctor.
I think you've got to have some common sense, too, because I think that's what Enjoy's saying, and I know that's what a force is saying at the same time. You got to have some common sense, because I came in one day to a good friend of mine. I love him with all my heart. I look over at him, and the man's sitting there, and he looks dead. And I said, are you all right? Are you all right, brother? And he looks at me, and he can't even breathe, and he's got like 40 bottles of medicine, and he's taking one medicine that's going to knock off the negative side effects of another medicine that's going to knock off the negative side effects of another medicine. He's taking one type of medicine that's supposed to help him stop smoking, and he looks like he's sitting there dying. And I said, "Don't you?" I said, "Why don't you stop taking that medicine? It looks like it's killing you. You can't even hardly breathe." And he's already on an oxygen machine, and it wasn't from smoking. I don't know what they gave him the oxygen machine for. He wasn't even a smoker. He wasn't even having to breathe. His breathing was good. And I don't know where the oxygen machine comes in at. I guess because he's just a smoker. But anyway, to make a long story short, he wasn't using his common sense. Anything they would tell him, he would do it. And if they told him to take these 35 medications, that's what he was doing. And finally, he got locked up. He got sent off to the big house, and he came out of there. And when he came out of there 4 or 5 years later, he looked like a brand new man. He looked like he was 20 years younger. And I'm telling you, I don't know what he done to get locked up, but that saved his life to me, because I deal with a lot of people and trying to help them get better. And when I looked at him that day, this was about 10 years ago, I knew he didn't have much longer. And I knew it was all those medicines he was taking. Now, that's the flip side. That's the other side. But the other side is, you know, I look at my niece, like she was born with diabetes, you know, and when she was 7 or 8, they found out that the level was like 600 or 700. The number was 600 or 700. And she has to have this pump on her and stuff. And we understand that's thinking right, doing the right thing. But at the same time, it's use common sense, you know. Don't just because they got a white coat and they've been through the, you know, learned for 20 years or whatever, that don't mean that they know more about your body than you do. But at the same time, they do know more about that blood work than you do. So you just got to use common sense in it, you know. Yeah, you just got to use common sense right. in it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Hey, Herbie.
Yeah,
and you know, to sum it up, this chapter it's really healing begins with belief, and that belief is magnified when the person believes that it will cure their symptom, whatever it might be, whatever it might be. Okay, that would be the end of that chapter. You want to start the next one, Bruce?
Well, I think it's really interesting, though, in summary for this chapter, how glucosamine and chondroitin, which everyone swears by for their joints, when it's been given a test, is no different than a placebo when it's tested in a double blind. And yet everyone notices these magnificent improvements, and it's simply because everyone says it works and they believe it works, and so it does work. So that is the power of belief that you're talking about.
A placebo can be a very powerful thing.
Or of most antidepressants. There aren't any studies that show that antidepressants work over placebo. Tiniest margins you can imagine. That's a completely different thing. Somebody's making money off of that, so it can promote it.
Yeah, so interestingly, if I can squeeze in a little bit here before we move on to the next chapter,
yeah.
I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Howard Schubiner today, and he'll be presenting this Sunday with the peer supervision group for TMS therapists, and he is writing a new book about anxiety and depression, talking about how modern biological psychiatry, they think of it often as a depression and anxiety as just a chemical thing. It's just that you need medicine, a neurotransmitter imbalance, they'll say. But he said, no, it's just like TMS. What's going on is that there's a fundamental unconscious tension, and that's where your symptoms are coming from. So I thought that was kind of interesting. He also cited a book recently came out by an editor of The Atlantic who said that a lot of the new research is showing that people really acclimatize to these antidepressant drugs, which makes a lot of sense. It's something that I've been thinking about for a while, which is you know, they study these drugs in order to get them approved, and they beat placebo, arguably, as Enjoy was saying, by only a narrow margin. But they only really test them for a short period of time. So they say, they compare the depression levels for people taking a placebo versus someone taking Prozac for 4 weeks. But are they really going to do a test that could figure out if people are, if it loses its effectiveness and you become just dependent on the drug after 2 years? I don't believe that that's required for a drug to be approved. So for all we know, it could be happening. And according to now, okay, this is a little bit third hand, but according to this book, this new book, that is what's happening. The people develop, they become, it stops becoming effective. Just like for me, my sometimes I get hay fever and those drugs stop working after a little while. I can't figure out who that was. Oh, well. trying to mute the noise. Possibly the same thing is going on there. Obviously, I haven't seen the research myself, so you'll want to check it out before you make any decisions, but I thought that was interesting.
Well, wow. Maybe drug will stop working because the neural receptors become atrophied as you take more and more of it, and eventually they get really atrophied, so you have to just increase the dosage logarithmically. That's how you get overdoses with heroin. Right. Dr. Gabramate goes into that quite extensively in the book on addiction that I'm reading right now. The realm of hungry ghosts.
Well, and that, I bet, takes it back to childhood again. Like he
again.
The hunger, where does the hunger for the drug, where does the hole come from that you fill with a drug? It comes from childhood, which I guess is very closely related to this chapter.
That's what that is at the core of his thesis, is that early childhood development issues, the bonding with the mother, parenting, the early stresses that a child undergoes permanently makes those receptors retarded. They cannot get the endorphins that give you a feeling of fullness. So that when you take a drink, a person who's susceptible like that, suddenly it's like they're completed. I was just seeing an interview with that guy Ryan and, what's his name? Those guys who were entertaining at New Year's Eve, Meckelberg and Ryan. Well, Meckelberg has he's a multi-million selling rap artist.
Prof.
Macklemore. Yeah, Macklemore. And he was saying in this interview that he has a alcohol problem, and when he goes off tour, when he's not getting the stimulation from the stage, if he takes one drink, he'll feel fulfilled, so that two will make him even more fulfilled, and so then the lid goes off. And I would be willing to bet that there was something in his early childhood that predisposed him for that. And as I told Herbie last week, I noticed that Keith Richards, the drug addict, genius guitarist with the Rolling Stones, was in fallout shelters with his mother in 1943-44 during the V1 and V2 attacks, which probably interfered with his development and bonding with his mother, because they were both in a anxiety-filled situation together in the early years. Yeah, not that with what is this endoplasticity, that the brain cannot heal itself. That's a point that Mate makes in the Hungry Ghost book. There is a capacity for healing in the brain,
but not a complete one. Not everything. You can heal some things, but it's slow, right?
Slow, yes, but it can be done if you change your environment and you have social support. But that's expensive too. Fixing an addict that way requires one-on-one, perhaps too high a price for society to be willing to pay.
Or an awesome nonprofit is what they need.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's what we all need. Perhaps I should start on chapter 25 now, since we're getting into suffering. Since we're talking about drugs as a cure to suffering, and now we're trying to find the meaning of suffering in this chapter entitled Passus. I think that's the pluperfect participle, the past perfect participle of the Latin verb to suffer. It's having suffered. And again, Steve prefaces it with a quote from Richard Rohr in his book, The Quest for the Grail. People who seem to be moving to greater levels of enlightenment and light actually experience darkness in more dramatic ways, and oftentimes more tragic ways than people who live in the safe middle, people who are comfortably nice. Greek drama called this the tragic flaw. It's called the hamartia, actually, in Aristotle, and it implies a tragic wound, like a scar, in the soul of the hero. It is said that every great person always had a tragic side, a tragic story, a secret wound that became the hole in the soul. The really great people I've met, says Rohr, when they late at night start telling you their story, there is always a big wound there, or a big mistake, or a dark side that they're never talk to anybody about, and you can't help but think that the very boxing ring they live in is part of what's made them great. Whether it's a huge mistake or a traumatic experience, deeper understanding often comes through suffering, or ego dissolves into light of consciousness. Knowledge can be purchased at any corner bookstore, but you can't buy understanding. Understanding comes through experience and through relating knowledge to that experience. And of course, now we come to the case of Michael Fox, who says he would not give up his Parkinson's disease for the life he lived before, the charmed life of an entertainer, of a star, because it's taught him so much. So that's what they call tragic knowledge in Greek tragedy too. What you've learned from this suffering. It's something that deepens you and improves you. It's something that you can't really turn your back on and throw away. It's the difference between innocence and experience, isn't it? It's like the doctrine of the fortunate fall too, felix culpa. You fell from grace, and that gave you the opportunity to learn something, to acquire this tragic knowledge that really was something that improved you. So it was a fortunate fall. If we'd always stayed in Eden, with like Adam and Eve, we wouldn't have an opportunity to learn in this flawed, tragic world we live in. Well, that's about as eloquent as I want to wax on this. But yeah, this is a important chapter, because in it, Steve addresses some of the major concerns of being human. What is the meaning of suffering? Something that Christ and Buddha both asked, you know, both poised as a question for us. And this is what Steve says: TMS pain, since we're on that topic, can be a blessing, since it provides the catalyst for needed change, which is what I was saying. Suffering also uncovers the deep desire for spiritual balance, because it unveils to the individual that he isn't happy, not on his own path, out of balance. Worrying, trying too hard, and complaining do not solve problems. Growth occurs not by solving problems, but by rising above them. Suffering is not the goal in life. It is an integral part of life that gives opportunity for creativity and growth, as it insists upon needed change. When we don't change, we don't grow. We are stuck in suffering, heading for more suffering. So Does that bring up any questions on anyone's part?
It probably brings up all kinds of questions. I think these questions has been getting brought up for thousands of years now. Does anybody want to bring up anything about what Bruce just talked about? Because while you was talking, Bruce, one of the things that came to my mind, Bruce, Forrest, everybody, is that have you ever seen somebody, and this is kind of off to the side a little bit, have you ever seen somebody, and when you look at them, it just seems like, I mean, they got everything. They got the cars, they got the homes, they got the money in the bank, and, you know, y'all become friends or whatever, or they might be your friend, they might be a relative or whatever, and you go to visit them at their house, and when you get there to visit them at their house, And you start hearing the way they talk about how life's just so terrible and how everything's just so whacked and how they just don't know why the dog has to walk on this side of the grass when why don't the dog walk on that side of the grass? You see, they, no matter how perfect it gets in life, there's those of us that will always find something to be mad about, to be angry about, to get upset about. Basically to suffer about, you know? And I remember Napoleon Hill, Napoleon Hill, he had a teaching, and it said something like this. The most beautiful teachings but the most beautiful paintings by Rembrandt. They look beautiful from, say, 15, 20 feet away. But when you get right up on them and you look real close, it's just a lots of smudges of paint, and it's not perfect anymore. When you look at the beautiful mountain from a distance and you go all the way and you get close up to that mountain, it's beautiful from a distance, and you're like, oh, it's so pretty. And then when you get right up on the mountain, it's just, a bunch of, it starts off with a bunch of dirt, and you know, it's just dirt. It's just a big pile of dirt and rocks, and it's not so beautiful anymore. The point is, we have this built-in part of us that wants to see that's, you know, the saying, the grass is always greener on the other side. That's for a reason. That's to give us a reason to keep moving forth, to keep looking for, you know, it's not about finishing the race. It's about the journey. It's about appreciating the journey, you know, because like people, when they retire and they think they finally got there, what happens? They not long, you know, and they go to be home with their Lord or their higher power. And my point is, you know, we can find something to suffer about and everything. But the point is, it's built on inside of us to always see the grass greener on the other side, because it's really the beauty of that grass that's supposed to make you happy, that's supposed to put joy in your life. And, you know, but we can either see that joy in it, or we can get too close to the painting, so to say, and let it make us suffer if we want to. So does that ring a bell? Have you ever seen or met anybody that's like that? That's always, you know, they're making up their own miseries, sort of say.
Yeah.
Anybody want to collaborate on that?
Ragging. They're always ragging.
Well, I remember times in my life, Bruce, Forrest, the North Star, Tennis Tom. I remember times in my life when, that I would just get upset so bad if something wasn't in order right. If it wasn't in order right, and if I couldn't find it, I would just get irate. And the thing is, that was just to teach me to do, you know, something better or appreciate a little bit of time to get to look for something. But I was looking at it like, you know, I wasn't the grass wasn't green enough, sort of say, and I just get too irate. But you go ahead.
You do notice that people who've been born with a silver spoon in their mouth, they have more tendency to look on the negative side of things and to be raggers. Nothing's ever good enough. nothing ever turns out right. And I think Steve says here in the at the start of the Passus chapter, the first section, it's dark inside the whale's belly. Anybody got a light? He says, history has shown a pattern of malignant narcissism in people who have never been down and out. The only path to spiritual expansion is to experience life in many ways. The more dramatic, the deeper the understanding. And I immediately thought of Caligula, who was raised in the palace of Tiberius on Corsica to be the emperor as his adopted son and had everything done for him. But he also absorbed this callous, brutal environment that Tiberius created around him, so that when he got to Rome, he was like a cruel infant. He'd never suffered as a human being. He tried to become an Egyptian god and marry his own sister. He took his racehorse and elevated him to be a senator, which might have been an astute political move on his part, tried to, you know, but he still was an awful, cunning, little nasty person. And he had never suffered. He was nasty to the end. And that's because he never had that tragic knowledge, that humanizing experience.
I believe, you know, we hear it a lot about, I've said it, and I mean it with all my heart. If I had to go back and change, you know, the 20 some odd years that I did suffer, that I was in pain, I wouldn't change it for nothing in the world, because of what it has taught me and how much I've grown from it and how much I've learned from it, because I'd rather stand back and see how beautiful the mountain is than get up, you know, right on it. And then it changed my whole, you know, chemistry of my body, because it wasn't what I thought it was. So, you know, the pain has showed me a lesson in life, and that lesson is to be thankful for everything that's out there that's good, that's beautiful, and even be thankful for the pain I went through, because it's helped me grow, and it's going to help me going into my later years, being stronger and helping my physiology stay stronger. I believe when you're happy, your body's just energetically stronger. I believe that in my heart. I don't know if there's a fact on that or not. I think there is. It's because scientists is coming out with so much now, you know. But is anybody else got a time or a person they might know, or a time in their life that, you know, you just went through something and it brought you out a better person?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Come on, Angela. Is that Angela?
Remember, Herbie, do you remember the comedian Richard Pryor? I think we all remember him.
Yeah, I grew up, that was my man, and he was a dirty talker, but I'd
dirty
slip
talker,
around and
but
laugh.
Yeah, he was hilarious. And you know, I mean, you probably know the story, but the thing is, to me, it's such a learning experience knowing what happened to Richard Pryor. I mean, his mother was a prostitute, his father was the madam that you know, was the mother of his mother, and he just grew up with such rage and such anger inside him, hated everything, hated everybody, and then he blew himself cane. He just burned himself up, and they did
trying
not
to smoke crack, right? He was smoking crack, and crack pipe blew up and burned himself
up. And yeah, it blew up, and he went running down the street, and they couldn't even, he was on fire, and they couldn't stop him, so he really got burned up.
Yeah.
And they thought there was not the slightest chance that he was going to live. And, but they finally got him, you know, got him stabilized, and he started to recover a bit. And they did all that stuff where they ripped those bandages off you. And it's the most agonizing thing the most agonizing thing in the world, mm-hmm. what he went through. And at the end of it, he said, I, what a gift from God. What a gift from God, because he finally faced all his issues, and he had to go inside himself, and he had to clean it up, And he said every time he turned to his higher power, he got help, and he realized that he could trust something outside itself, and that he had been dead wrong on his take on life, you know. And to me, like, I mean, I hate pain, you know. I hate it. I want everything to work for me and work properly, right? But the fact of the matter is, that's what we need in this life. We need this suffering to get us to settle down and get serious about figuring out who we are and where we are and what to do with it.
Yeah, that brings up that quote that Steve inserts in the text on page 268. He says that Carl Jung wrote, quote, "There is no coming to consciousness without pain. And through suffering, the unconscious rises toward consciousness. We learn or grow from suffering, most likely because we aren't yet evolved enough to have the ability to grow without it." So there's that. There again is the felix culpa, the necessary fall. The necessary agent is pain for growth.
Yeah.
It's something you got to go through to humanize yourself, or else you'll wind up like Caligula. Or another narcissist, little rich boy of some kind.
Yeah.
Wow. And when you growing up, you touch the hot stove, and it teaches you a lesson not to touch the hot stove no more. And at the same time, suffering teaches us lessons on things we don't need to do. As in the case with Richard Pryor. He went through something that taught him a lesson and you know, how to be stronger in life. And, I think the people that can grab a hold of that, the people that can grab a hold of those life lessons, they go on and they go to that higher level of consciousness that so many of us want, so many of us talk about, so many of us reach and search for all the time. And it's through the valley, it's through that valley, it's through that hard suffering that a lot of times, or just about every time, that you learn how to get to that higher level of consciousness, you know?
Yeah, every negative situation can be turned into an opportunity if you approach it in the right way. When I was laid up with TMS for 9 months, I began to study the deer in the backyard and their interactions, and I wrote a great big article for Bay Nature on deer in the suburbs and their social life, because I was housebound.
Yeah.
Because it forced me to notice things around me and observe closely. And I remember when I broke my heel, it forced me to sit down with a test set and learn how to work the test set and write manuals on network testing. So I could have just sat there and bitched and moaned about being in agony and my life ruined, but instead I converted it into something that I could use as a tool to learn with. Because I was stuck with it. So, you know, why not make the most of the opportunity it gives you?
Wow.
I think everything's like that.
That's awesome.
If you look at it the right way.
Yeah, that reminds me of Eckhart Tolle, you know, when he said he sat there for 2 or 3 hours, I believe, and watched the cat look at the mouse hole. And he was just paying attention to the cat and how the cat was just relaxed but poised at the same time, you know, and totally alert but in the now, right there. And he was watching for the mouse to come out of the mouse hole. And he said, and then his question was, is anybody sit and watch the cat, you know, look at a mouse hole for 2 or 3 hours? And the answer, you know, is being in the now. It was being in the now. But could you imagine the people that sit in doctors' waiting rooms and suffer and get stressed out just because they're sitting there waiting? And at that moment that you might think you're suffering, you could pick a magazine up, learn something new. You know, you can learn so much from just listening to a story about a man watching a mouse hole. You know, he came into, he was in the now. He was being in the now. Everybody's heard that story, right?
Mm-hmm.
About how it brought him into the now, and the cat is totally in the now and totally just absorbing the present moment, and it's not worried, it's not, you know, upset, it's just in the now. Being in the now is a powerful thing to get you out of suffering too.
That sounds like Michael Brown when he got that nerve condition where it put him into just total pain, suffering day and night, and he learned to, that gave him an opportunity to learn how to be in the now.
Yeah.
It made him focus on the presence process and gave him the key he needed to solve the mystery
of
his life.
Yeah, something that should have been suffering for him, he learned something beautiful from it, and look how many people he's helped. Look how many people that book, The Presence Process, has helped. It's an awesome book. Wow, does anybody want to elaborate on what we have been talking about? North Star, Tennis Tom, enjoy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it's so interesting. We just we kind of got ourselves caught up here in a conversation with a person who called in or came in for the first time on the chat.
Uh-huh.
So I'm getting myself distracted. So.
Oh, you're doing okay. You just do what you're doing. North Star, you want to say anything?
I think we lost her. She had to go, I think. Yeah.
Tennis Tom, you gone? Okay. Oh, there he is.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, being in the now. Actually, no, I can't think of anything to say on the topic right now, but...
because you're in the now right now, right?
I'll pass on that for the moment. Thank you.
Well, I'd also be interested in hearing the Tennis Tom take on drugs. Would that be okay, Herbie?
Well, the overall question for us was, you know, have you ever been through something that at the time you were suffering, but, you know, when it was all said and done, you learn a life lesson from it. That was the overall question, Tennis Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I've been through a lot of depressions and going through one now, and you learn from it, and there's good things that come out of it if you try to keep some positive viewpoint on it, and I guess I'd like to say something about Steve's book overall. I'm glad this group is here, because otherwise I'd still be reading it like, you know, one sentence per day or something. So you guys are kind of egging me on. And I've even gone ahead a couple of chapters, and I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think Steve's really a genius at it. And I hope someday he gets his just dues. And maybe goes on Oprah, because that's kind of the golden scale of, success as a writer these days, if you've been on Oprah.
Yeah.
He deserves it. So I hope he does, because, I don't know, boy. And Steve went through a lot of suffering. And look at how, what a positive attitude, and it created... this great TMS book out of it.
Yes, so yes. True. Look how, and when he comes to the forum, to the TMS Wiki forum, look at the words, and look at the how he talks, and how really he's enlightened. I mean, this is a person that when you read what he writes, you can just tell his suffering has made a whole new person, and it's just, it's amazing to see the person, Steve Wright, and who he is in his writings, because you can just hear it in his, whatever he says to anybody. You know he's happy, you know it, when he gets on here and he speaks, and he, does his lessons on here with us, we just all be quiet and listen, you know, because yeah. he learned a lot through his suffering,
page,
you know.
269, he says, suffering pushes us toward growth until we reach a certain level of awareness and then are suddenly pulled toward our predetermined path, toward our ultimate self, the truth. It is an intrinsic part of the human condition. And then he goes on about the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. Just learning through suffering is part of the human condition. It's the way it is.
Yeah, I think one downfall of our present culture is that most people aren't really suffering. They think they're suffering, but they're not really suffering. They just go to the supermarket and buy food or anywhere. They have no wants, really, of life's necessities. But what their wants are, you know, more, we're in a materialistic culture, and, you know, me too. Steve keeps emphasizing relationship and, our culture these days, I think it's kind of the breakdown of relationships, the breakdown of the family. In the past, the relationship was your family, and now your relationship is with your government. And government's going to provide everything or take it all away. I think there's some saying, beware, a government that can provide everything can also take it away from you. So in the old days, the family was the core of your relationship and what made you happy or sad. And today, we're well off enough that we can all be independent and not need any relationships to exist. You know, it's for food. We live in a society where most of us have the choice of being independent and living alone. And I think that's kind of the big, that's what Steve alludes to all the time, is relationships are good or bad or are the core of where TMS comes from. And
so our very affluence then, Tom, makes us isolated, alone, unconnected. You think that's
right?
The price of success is alienation, is social alienation, material success, at least, you know, the food supply system.
All of our needs are easily met. You know, you go down to Safeway and just stick your hand on that shelf and that orange juice magically appears from that farmer in Florida. You know, we have no direct connection to any of, we don't grow anything anymore, which is great, you know. I mean, it's wonderful. It allows us to spend a lot of time philosophizing or going to movies or reading books. So that's good, you know. We should appreciate all this stuff that we have, because someday if we lose it, we'll say, damn, you know. Those were the good old days.
I mean, I think that the key is just keeping it in perspective and saying, okay, we do live in a culture of prosperity, but, you know, how can we maintain our values? And I think a lot of people are really good at it, but I think, you know, it's so easy to forget, you know, that to put family first, to put relationships first, to put ourselves first, and to help prioritize.
Awesome. You might add, some of us do. Some of us have these needs met. Yeah, the white toast guy who goes out and appreciates the orcas in the Gulf of Alaska gets to have an ecological consciousness, but not everyone gets to do this. They're more interested in eating whale meat some places.
Wow. Here at the end, I like this sentence in Steve's book. He says, suffering can be another word for learning. I think that is awesome. It's about time to wrap it up, guys. I think this has been an awesome show tonight. I want to thank everybody. Enjoy. I want to thank Bruce, Forrest, Tennis Tom, everybody that spoke up and talked, and everybody that was here to listen, Amy, and anybody else that I might have missed. Joseph, I just want to thank everybody for being here, because it's exciting to us to know that you guys come in here and we can sit here and talk about this and we can learn and heal together. And that's a special thing in my heart, and I know it is in all of our hearts. And that, like Tennis Tom was saying just a minute ago about relationship, it is relationship. That's how we heal. We get together, we talk, we learn, we grow, right? But anyway, we're going to be on to our other chapters next week. It'll be told on the forum. I just want to say thank you. We spoke about what drugs can do, how they can be helpful, and how they cannot be helpful. And we spoke about suffering and how it can be helpful. So with that being said, that'll be the end of the show tonight. And thank you, everyone.